Welcome to another broadcast of Aging Without Wrinkles on the Artist First Radio Network. All past shows are archived. You can pick them up at artistfirst.com. And now out to your host, it's Miss Harriet Tramer.
Thank you, Scott. Emotional and other issues can make it hard for some people to navigate their way through life's potholes, but professionals, such as the guests who will be joining me tonight, can help them deal with the challenges they encounter. Dr. Wynn Henderson, my first guest, helps people manage addictions that might be impeding their lives on many levels. And through the Ohio-based Center for Cognition and Development, Dr. Lee DeLorge works with young people who need some help fine-tuning their mental processing. Wynn, welcome to the show, and I hope things are going well for you down there in North Carolina.
They are, Harriet. Thank you very much for having me on tonight.
What exactly do you mean? I know it's an old term paper tactic, but I can't help myself. I'm an instructor. What do you mean when you talk about addictions? What is the difference, for example, between having a glass of wine every evening and being addicted? What do you mean by that when you talk about addiction?
Okay, Harriet, let me give you my definition of addiction. If you come to understand that one or more of your behaviors is hurting you or hurting someone you love, and you can't stop it for whatever reason, then you're addicted to that behavior.
But wouldn't it be hard for some people to have that degree of self-awareness? If you are, for example, a heavy smoker, and everybody around you is smoking, wouldn't you possibly come to believe that's just what people do? Doesn't it require some real self-awareness to see you're harming yourself and others?
Well, Harriet, that could be true to a certain extent, but there's hardly anybody in the country who listens to the news and, you know, is alert that does not know that smoking is bad for you and will cause you to die quicker. You may be in denial and want to bring up all kinds of reasons why that doesn't apply to you, but the situation is that at some level, you know that your behavior is hurting you or hurting someone you love.
And couldn't that awareness cause you to get deeper into the behavior? In other words, I'm drinking, and I know it's harming me and others around me, and I can't really deal with that. Couldn't that cause me to get deeper into my addiction?
Well,
realizing it's out of control and being frightened?
I don't think so. I think that once you get to that stage, the idea that you are suffering from a disease is not going to make it worse.
Now, you have been dealing with addiction issues for how long?
30 years.
30 years. That's a long time in a fast-moving society. Do you find the fact that people are under great pressure these days is causing them to become addicted?
No, it's not the pressure, Harriet, that's causing them to be addicted. In a medical model, I'm a medical doctor, and if I have a patient that comes in and I diagnose pneumonia, for example, well, I need to know what the cause of that pneumonia is before I can treat it effectively. If it's a bacterial pneumonia, then I give the patient antibiotics. If it's a viral pneumonia, giving them antibiotics wouldn't do any good. Same way with the disease of addiction. You need to know what causes it. And the unfortunate truth of the matter is that very few people know what causes addiction. I'm one of them that does, and I can tell your listeners tonight.
Why don't Okay, I come into you, we'll role play here a minute. I come into you and I say, I'm drinking 5 glasses of wine a day, or it's not wine, I'm being polite, heavy liquor a day, I'm addicted. Dr. Henderson, I don't know what's causing that. Can you help me? How would you start to try to help me?
Well, I would say, yes, I can help you. And the first thing that you need to know is, what is causing this disease? And I'll tell you what's causing the disease. It's two things. It's low self-esteem. You don't value yourself high enough. And so you're looking around in society for something to make you feel good, to fill the void, so to speak. And secondly, the reason that you're having this problem is because you have inadequate spiritual consciousness. You don't know spiritually some things. There's four questions that I would like to ask you if you know the answer to.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, who am I? Where did I come from? What am I doing here? And where am I going when I'm done? If you
okay.
can answer those questions and apply them to your life, you don't have to worry too much about addiction. But
now, what if somebody says, get smarty on you, smarty pants on you, and says, Dr. Henderson, what am I doing here? I'm drinking. What's my purpose in life? You know, empty a few wine glasses.
Well,
nobody knows the answer to these questions.
Yeah. Well, I would say that there is a way I write about in my books how you can find out what your purpose, your mission is, because I know that every person on the planet, all 8 billion people, have a purpose, a mission, a reason for being here. And if you would like for me to tell you how to find your purpose, I can do that.
How would you find your purpose? How would you do that?
Well, it's the prayer and meditation cycle. You pray the question, and you wait for the answer. And sooner or later, you get it. The prayer is, if I had no limitations, neither financial or educational or any other type of limitations, because in truth, you don't unless you put them on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, if I did not care what anybody else thought, not my parents, not my children, not my business associates, not the guy down the street, what would I do with the rest of my life that would be of the greatest service to humanity, the world, the people that I see, so that on ending I could say, I have worked on my purpose for my entire life after this question.
Mm-hmm. Now, you obviously have asked many people these questions, either on a one-to-one level, on your radio show. What type of answers have you gotten that makes you think people really are finding some satisfaction with their understandings of their lives?
Well,
are not just playing, but have really come to some understandings.
Well, when you have developed your spiritual consciousness enough that you understand the truth of the universe, everything changes for you. You're not the same person that you were before you got that understanding. And when those things change in your life, you don't want or need the things that you thought you wanted or needed before, because you have a real reason for being, and you're going to be trying to bring that into consciousness, bring that to fruition before you die.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example of somebody you believe has done that? Maybe you've done that. Maybe other people you've talked to. Give us an example so I have a better understanding of just what you mean.
Well, some years ago, I was counseling this young man, and he was poly abuser. He would take anything if he thought it would get him high. I think that he would snort peanut butter. Peanut butter, if he thought that it would get him high. He would try anything to get high. So he got into AA and NA and started going to meetings to try to cure his addictive problem with substance abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to as many as 30 meetings per week.
30?
30 meetings per week in order to not be doing the substance abuse.
That's like 60 hours a week of meetings.
That's all he was doing in his life.
Uh-huh.
And that worked, but what he did was he swapped one addictive behavior for another one.
Mm-hmm.
Now he was addicted to 12-step meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I went through this program with him, and he understood it, and he developed a purpose in life. And his purpose was now to help those other people in the 12-step program make a change, a radical change in their lives. So he threw his energy into helping other people. And when he did that, he didn't want those drugs anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think you are answering the next question, a very ticklish one, but it rather needs to be asked because it's so pertinent. If I am, for example, addicted to substance X, whatever substance X is, and I have a high-pressure job, and others are addicted to substance X, it's almost expected in my work. Do I have to change my entire life, my work, to deal with my addiction? Because being around people who share my addiction is just too stressful. I can't handle it.
Well, I'm asked that question often with respect to alcohol. And part of my 5-step program that will cure you from addiction in the spiritual realm means changing associations. In other words, an alcoholic should not take a job as a bartender. You get my drift?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to complicate the fact that you're trying to get well by throwing yourself right into an environment is going to cause you all the time stress from saying no. A smoker doesn't need to hang out with people smoking on breaks at work. So, yeah, changing your associates or associations is something that you quite often have got to do.
Isn't it pretty common if somebody is, for example, has a problem with alcohol, that those they associate with, either on the job or personally or maybe even family, share that situation?
Well, I guess you're asking me if alcoholics share their situation with other alcoholics. Is that the question?
Yes.
Well, yes, that's true, because if you go into a bar, you're going to see a lot of alcoholics having a good time, or they think they may be having a good time drinking.
Mm-hmm.
But that alcoholic would not be having the same kind of stress if he was going to church instead of to the bar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand what you're saying. I went into a restaurant the other day to meet some people, and no, I was not hanging out in the bar, but there was a bar in the front of the restaurant. Then we went. The group I was with was way in the back. Now, one man came up and started talking to me real friendly. Oh, you look lonely, this or that. Wow, if I'm somebody who's looking for companionship, that's pretty easy to fall into. And the next thing is I'm probably going to be having a drink with him.
Okay. So what's your question?
I'm just pointing out how these associations work. How, if you have this problem and you have the low self-esteem, you feel, wow, here's somebody paying attention to me, how easy it can be to fall into some of these things.
Well, that sounds like the easiest way to get into relationship or sex addiction is by letting somebody build up your ego, build up your self-esteem by complimenting you or saying you're pretty or whatever, because that's the underlying cause of addiction to start off with. And if they know that you have low self-esteem, then they can start talking to you in order to get you into the bar or into the bed.
Now, you talk about low self-esteem. Mightn't it be easy to form low self-esteem in our society when you go on Facebook and everybody is presenting this beautiful picture of their life, when you turn on the TV and people are walking around in these very expensive clothes and you see cars advertised that you know you can't afford, you see houses advertised you know you cannot afford. In this world where everything is so marketed, isn't it very easy to fall into low self-esteem?
Well, you have to know the truth of the matter as far as self-esteem goes. You have to understand that whether or not you have a fancy car or home or a lot of money in the bank, you are still a valuable person. The way to understand that is through spiritual consciousness elevation. In other words, if you realize the truth of the situation, and the truth is this, I am a child of God, I have characteristics of God, and so therefore I am a very valuable entity. And if you can get that into your head, all this other stuff doesn't make any difference.
When you talk about spiritual, you mean something beyond your physical, what you're wearing, where you live, what you're driving, something beyond that.
Absolutely. Some people call it metaphysical. Beyond your five senses.
Now, we've talked about, and I mean, it's nothing to talk about, and it's obvious how if you have an addiction, you can be drawn to other people who do. If you are looking for spiritual growth, is there something about that process that will draw you to people who are also looking for spiritual growth?
Well, you know, these days they have an internet company called meetup.com.
And all over the country.
And they have meetup groups for hiking, photography, whatever. You could join a meetup group for spiritual growth and go to their meetings, and that would be a lot better than, you know, doing the things that you've been doing that have been addictive and have caused you a lot of pain and suffering.
We've talked about many different types of addictions. I mean, there's any number, gambling, alcohol, drugs, cigarettes, sex, any number. Are there any that are hard to cure, that are the hardest? You talk about low self-esteem being beyond all of these. Are there any of these addictions that are the hardest to cure?
Yeah, there is one. And that is the addiction of being a sociopath.
Wow.
A sociopath is a person who believes that they deserve whatever they want. And they are willing to do anything to anybody to get it. And as long as that's your belief, you'll never become free of addiction.
And that's common?
Well, I don't know what the incidence of sociopaths in our country is, but there's a lot of them around, and all they want is what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there have been serial murderers that were sociopaths, and politicians who have been sociopaths. You just have to look into their personality. Sometimes they're so good at conning you that you don't understand where they're coming from until it's too late. And that's a real shame.
And these people probably have a way of promising you exactly what you want and what you don't know how to get but think you need.
Well, that's a good definition of a con artist.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, a con artist gives you what you want or makes you think that you're going to get what you want.
Right, that's also a good definition of marketing.
Yeah.
Now, you say you have been dealing with some addiction issues for 30 years. You're human. Have there been times when you felt very disappointed, when you felt, I just can't help these people? They seem not to want help. I can't do much here.
Well, as a matter of fact, I've had my radio show where I try to show people how important it is to have a mission, a purpose in life. And about into it, year 14, 15, somewhere in there, I was getting a little disappointed. But then I had a guest on my program, let's call him Jim, and he died and went to heaven. And when he went to heaven and talked to God, God told him many of the same things that I had when I had a spiritual experience conversation with God in November of 1990. And I figured if God gave him this specific information and he gave it to me and we didn't know each other and we were telling the truth and everything, must be the right stuff. So, you know, after that series of interviews, I interviewed him six times.
Wow.
I got over the disappointment, and I just got strong enough to keep going. And I think I'm strong enough to keep going for the rest of my life now.
That encounter was something that happened unexpectedly, or was something that you would have expected?
No, it was totally unexpected. I didn't know what he was going to say. We didn't talk about it ahead of time. Yeah, it was just a program of someone who had had a near-death experience. But the specifics of his near-death experience and the specifics of my conversation with God in 2000, having so many things in common, I did not take that to be a coincidence. And that gave me, you know, a lot of feeling that I'm on the right track. I need to continue. It's a long journey, but it's a very worthwhile journey, because if you can do three things, I can guarantee any listener out there tonight that they can cure themselves of whatever their addictive behavior is. Never found any failures if they do three things.
And those three things are?
First, you have to really want to get well. Most of the addictive behavior people don't really want to get well. They might say they do. They might say, well, I want to get well if it's as easy as taking a pill. But in your heart, you have to be at a level that you say, I've had it. I don't want this anymore. I will do whatever it takes if someone would tell me how to do it to get mm-hmm. That's the first thing. And that knocks out 90-something percent of the people that have addiction. Second thing is, this is the most powerful spiritual concept.
They knocks out meaning they can't do that.
Yeah. The second thing is, they have to believe in their heart, not in their head, that this program can cause them to get rid of their addiction. Belief is the second most important thing. So first, you have to want to get well. Secondly, you have to believe you can get well. And the third thing, as a result of those two things, you have to show up and do the work. I've got the plan in my book, Freedom from Addiction, where you can do the program at home without taking any time off from work. And you can just go through the thing and do the work. And if those three things are operative, you will get well.
Mm-hmm. You've seen that happen.
Yeah, hundreds,
over the years.
Hundreds of times.
Wow. Wow. Now, you mentioned before about spirituality, about something that is beyond just your physical body and what surrounds it. Does this belief make you less frightened of aging? In other words, does this lead you to think that's just my body? I will always be here in a spiritual sense?
Well, absolutely, because our soul, the essence of us, does not die.
Mm-hmm.
It moves on. Mm-hmm. And there is nothing to fear in dying. And if you've had a near-death experience, you understand that. And millions of people on the planet have had a near-death experience, died, came back, and they came back with a different point of view. There's nothing mm-hmm. to fear about dying. So you can put all your living into being the most creative person, the most helpful person to others that you can be. And you don't have to worry about dying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do more people have these near-death experiences than might express it?
Yeah, a lot of people are, and more people all the time, are expressing their near-death experiences. There was a time when you thought you were weird, you didn't really have that experience, whatever, in the past, but as people are telling about their experiences and more people are hearing it, I talk about it on my radio show quite a bit, and it's happening mm-hmm. all over the world, and people say, well, he had an experience, she had an experience. Maybe there's something to this, and there mm-hmm. is something to that. We don't quit just when we die. We go
mm-hmm.
on.
Mm-hmm. And you think there's more acceptance now of these ideas?
Absolutely. More acceptance all the time. Every time a person writes a book on 4,000 near-death experiences or whatever, and people read that book, they're going to be more in tuned to believing that this is not the end of the line. It's not just a switch, a light switch being turned off, and then that's it. That your soul will go on.
Mm-hmm. Wynn, thank you very much for being my guest. And if somebody would like to get in contact with you to learn more about your work and your books, how can they do that?
Well, of course, Freedom from Addiction is available at Amazon.com, but my website is freedomfromaddiction.info, not .com, .info. And I do a podcast on iTunes. You go to iTunes, download it, go to the podcast section of iTunes, go into the alternative health category and search for Freedom from Addiction. And then you can hear 24/7 my programs and their archive. Anytime you want to find out something about addiction or purpose in life, just go over to iTunes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, and I hope that people will look up more information, because these are fascinating things.
Well, it's a life-saving thing, and when you get to the point that you know that your life is not what you want it to be, here's the answer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Folks, stay tuned, because there's much more to come. Our next guest, Dr. Lee LaGeorge, has many fascinating things to say about helping young people who maybe need a little rewiring of their mental processes so they can live to their potential. So stay tuned, and you'll hear much more of interest.
Not all criminals carry a gun or a knife. Some simply need to pick up the phone or ring a doorbell. In times like these, senior citizens are often the targets of con artists, hawking shady investment deals and phony charities. Be wary of strangers in your neighborhood soliciting services or asking for money. Many cons come in the way of phony home repair services. These thieves offer major home repairs at bargain prices, but they end up taking your money and never finishing the work. Don't become a victim. Be skeptical of offers that are too good to be true. Never allow anyone to force you to sign something, and never give personal information to people you don't know. Get estimates and never pay in advance. If you suspect fraud, get the contractor's license plate number and call the police immediately. If something doesn't seem right, it's probably not. Protect yourself. Visit ncpc.org to learn more. A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Get ready, Jade. I've got a surprise adventure you're going to love.
Really?
We're going to swim with Sally the tiger cub. Even get a photo with her that you can share with all your friends.
I don't want to go, Mom.
You feel all right, Jade? I thought you'd love this.
I'm okay, but I feel terrible for those poor tiger cubs. Did you know that they're stolen from their mothers the day they're born?
What?
Yeah. How'd you feel if someone kidnapped me at birth?
Well...
And when the cubs do normal things like nip and paw, they're punished so they'll sit still for photos. And how would you feel if you were a baby and they pushed you into a deep pool to swim for your life?
I never thought about it that way.
And when they get too big to pet, they end up being imprisoned in tiny cages.
Where'd you learn all that?
From StopBigCatAbuse.com.
Studies show that children who learn compassion for animals show more compassion for humans. So teach your children well. Learn more at StopBigCatAbuse.com.
You are listening to Aging Without Wrinkles on the Artist First Radio Network. All past broadcasts are archived, and you can pick them up at artistfirst.com. And now out to your host, it's Harriet Tramer.
Our previous guest, Dr. Wynn Henderson, was from sunny North Carolina, which is a good place to be, particularly in the spring when it's still cold up north. Dr. Lee DeGeorge comes from guess where, right down the street where I live. I met her one morning when I was walking, and we started talking. Her dog was who brought us together, and that is how it happened. She's on the show. Lee, welcome to the program. We're glad to have you.
Thank you, Harriet. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Now, you help young people who may need a little rewiring of their mental processes so they can function better.
Correct. I deal with the brain's neuroplasticity. I rewire rewire the brain to impact processing speeds and memory, short, long-term memory, mostly short.
Okay. Now, you work with young people.
Yes, I typically have young students. They range anywhere from first grade up into high school. I have had adult students. I've had adult students who've had traumatic brain injuries, adult students who have autism or Asperger's, various different diagnoses. But yes, the majority of my clientele is younger children who are just struggling with academics and the rate at which they do their work.
Now, the big question here. You work with these students. Don't you sometimes get a real resistance from them? I'm fine. I'm going to be a musician. I'm going to be a rock star. I'm going to be an athlete. Why are you bothering me about brain processing? Hey, you know, I'm the head pitcher on the baseball team. I'm this, I'm that. Why are you concerning me with these things? I'm going to do something else.
You know, I have run across that. Oftentimes, based on the metronome approach that I use with them, I will say to them, well, do you want to be better at that? Because if you're better at that, what we're doing here is going to even impact your athletic abilities. But some of my more resistant athletic kids, for example, I'll ask them, what happens if you get a sports injury and all of a sudden you can't play your dream job in the NBA or the NFL or whatever passion you have? What are you going to do?
And they say that's not going to happen.
You know what? I've run across it maybe a couple times, but typically children that come here, no matter what age they are, they don't feel positive about their abilities, and they do want the help. They do want to make things different. Yes, there are children that, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do this, but most of the ones that resist wanting to do it or have those types of excuses, they're really afraid, and they'd rather not then face something that makes them feel as if they failed. So they're going to naturally migrate to things that make them feel good about themselves, and they're going to focus on that, even if sometimes it's unrealistic, like I'm going to become a professional ball player.
Okay, how do you get through that bluster? What you're talking about is bluster. Of course it's hiding fear. Everybody knows that. But how do you get through that bluster? We'll role play. I'm 17-year-old, and I play tennis, and I'm going to be the next Serena Williams, so don't bother me. And don't talk to me about an injury. I'm 17, my age, don't have injuries. How can you respond to something like that?
Well, would you want to make sure you're the best? Because I can help you get through that. And I will point out, for example, with the interactive metronome, the various athletes that actually have participated in doing the interactive metronome.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a little bit more open. If they see that it's going to make it easier for them to succeed at their dream, they do have a little bit more of the buy-in. But in all honesty, it's my job to motivate them to even try it, and I purposely set it so that they have small successes, and then I express out the difficulties. They have to feel a small success to let go of some of that bluster.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned about metronome. Give me an example of how that works and how somebody might have small successes.
Well, the interactive metronome itself is actually designed to synchronize and improve the efficiency of the brain's inner clock. It improves temporal processing and neurological efficiency. I'll give them a task to do where they have a reference tone that they have to respond to, and it might be I have them, you know, clap in a circle at a certain beat, and they have to match that. I'm purposely going to set the difficulty so that it's a little easier so that they are feeling success. So if it's somebody who has a little bit of attention deficit and they're real impulsive, I'm going to set the rate of the reference tone so that it comes more quickly. And it's done kind of in video game format, which kids are really into today, and I kind of have an aversion personally towards it, to be honest with you. But I set it up so that they're seeing that their scores are getting better and better, and then they're going to want to do it more. Mm-hmm. I vary the screens. Some of them, for little girls, they like, you know, they like the fairies. They like soccer. Some of them like basketball. Some of the boys like the fishing games that are on the metronome. So I pick what the child's interested in. I get them to make a choice, the student make a choice, and, you know, set it from there. Once they find that they're succeeding at it, I tighten things up, and they have to, you know, find a... They have to pursue. If they don't want to do it, then again, I work with them. I encourage them. And that, to be honest with you, is the hardest part of my job, because sometimes when they're really discouraged, it can be very difficult to encourage them through some of their frustrations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, these students you work with, young people you work with, they're referred to you by the schools, by their parents, by themselves, self-referral. How are they referred to you?
It's a combination. Typically, my older clients, my adult students that come to me, you know, that's clearly self-driven. I do have a couple of schools that make recommendations. I do have mostly pediatricians. Dr. Senders is very well known here on the east side, and his practice is very good about sending students to me. Families whose children have succeeded through the program will often send other people they know whose children struggle. So it's really been word of mouth, a lot of different pediatricians, a lot of families. The children, when they first come here for testing, a lot of them do want to come back because, again, I try and make it fun and interesting for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that answers that.
Well, yeah. When you talk about succeeding, how would you measure that? They get better grades at school? They do better at the interactive metronome? How would you measure succeeding?
It's actually a combination, again, of all of that. I can always tell by the scores on the metronome and the different tasks I do at the table. I'm very, very diligent about keeping records and seeing week to week or session to session what growth that they have. And when they are feeling discouraged, I can say, look at this. Last week you could only do 1, 2, 3. Now you can do 1, 2, 3 through 7. Parents will see it in their grades. Students themselves see it based on, wow, it took me only 30 minutes to do my homework instead of an hour and 30 minutes, or something comes easy to them and they are, wow, I got this done so easy. This was actually easy. I passed the test. I got an A on my test. So it really is a little bit of all of that. I have a plethora of thank you letters and notes on my bulletin board in the office of children who said, it was so nice that, you know, you did this. I now can take tests and not be afraid. Or some students will say, you know what, if I get one wrong, it's really okay because I learned how to do it different next time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge component to self-esteem through having their brains rewired.
Now, I'm still not quite understanding. The interactive metronome, you have to do certain tasks in certain period of time?
Yes, I will set the time. So, for example, let's take a student who might have attention deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't sit for more than, they can't attend to something for more than 5 minutes. I will set a series of tasks, and the metronome is a reference bell that they hear, and they have to clap to it or step to it. And I apologize for that. Sometimes they'll just stand there for 10 minutes as they progress and just clap to the sound of the reference bell. They watch on the screen a basketball, and they try and get the basket based on how they clap. So the program is set that if you get the right millisecond response, the ball goes right into the basket. Mm-hmm. And there's visual and auditory cues with the program that will allow the student to see or feel whether they're going too fast or too slow, and they can adjust their movements based on that. Once they adjust their movement and they start getting better scores, I add more difficult tasks. So I might put random numbers up on the wall. And they have to keep the beat of the metronome with the visual and auditory cues. At the same time, look at these numbers, and I might say to them, okay, I want you to tell me what's two more than each of these numbers. So they keep their beat, and they have to go through, and instead of saying 7 plus 2 is 9, they just look at the 7, they have to tell me 9 on beat.
7, boom, 9, like music.
I'm sorry?
It would be like 7, boom, 9, at to the beat, like music.
Yes.
Now, I assume the objective of this is to train students so they can set their own agenda, manage their own time.
Yes, it's very impactful for time management. It's you know, again, because the brain operates on a timing and a rhythm, mm-hmm. improving the timing or rhythm, it impacts how the brain processes and responds to stimuli. So if you are constantly unorganized and you have poor time management, when you're lining up the timing and rhythm within your brain, you're able to start planning and sequencing tasks and activities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Something so simple as, you know, students with executive function, for example, their stuff is all over the place. They might have paperwork here and science project here, and they're not turning it in. They're very bright kids, but they're not turning in their material, so their grades are going down. This will help develop a pattern or a timed rhythm within their brain so that they're more able to remember what they need to do. They're more motivated to organize their folders, to make sure they're turning things in effectively.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about hyperactivity. Big debate about if they should have Ritalin or some type of pharmaceutical medication. Do you work with psychiatrists in determining these things? Do psychiatrists get reports from you? Do you work with them? You're not a medical doctor.
No, I'm not a medical doctor. My doctorate's in educational psychology. It's not clinical, but because it's usually doctors that will send, or psychiatrists that send students to me, I will communicate with them and say, here's what I'm finding. The majority of families that come to me because they do not want their children on pharmaceuticals. They don't want their students medicated. And part of why I started doing this is my son had attention deficit and dyslexia, but he was highly allergic to medicine. And the one medicine that they did find that he wasn't allergic to, it changed who he was. I didn't even recognize his eyes, and I said, that's it, I'm not putting him on medicine. So I found this through research. I did most of my doctoral research specifically on how this impacts the brain. And if a child can have this alternative approach and not need medicine, most parents want to see that for their children. Most children want to see that, because a lot of students who do come here who are on some level of medication, they hate it. They don't want to take it. They tell me they feel different.
Mm.
There are times when I have a student that I may say to a family, you know what, here's, you know, go back to your doctor, go back to your psychiatrist, and talk to them about possible low dose, because sometimes the low doses do impact so that the metronome processing or the comprenetic blocks that I do with the students, they grasp it more readily, and they sometimes can be weaned off of it. Sometimes they just stay on a low dose instead of a high dose. Sometimes if the student's on a high dose, because of the things, they can go to lower doses. So, you know,
is there a chance that you just leave them to their own devices so these young people's brains will mature and they will no longer be as vulnerable to some of the flights of fancy you're discussing?
Yes, and again, that's going to deal with neuroplasticity. For example, there's actually a very good one of the one of my clients. The father had severe dyslexia, but learned how to work around it enough that he's a very, very well-to-do attorney who is now an avid reader.
Mm-hmm.
It's in finding one approach that works and sticking with it, that is what neuroplasticity is all about. It rewires, reprocesses. So it's not so much that you outgrow it as you develop a strategy that rewires your brain to actually work the way it needs to work. Now, yes, you can wait until you're older. You can struggle, or a lot of parents will bring their students to me, their children to me, because they don't want them to struggle the way they did. And a lot of my families will say, I had the same problem as a child, or I felt this way and I don't want my child to feel this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some kids will get so discouraged that they take the wrong path and they don't find themselves till years later, and they've lost a lot of opportunity to really succeed where they could have. And as we all know, we can't go backwards and say, I wish I could do it over. Hindsight is what, 2020, is that what they say?
Mm-hmm. I understand. Now, can anybody at any age benefit from neuroplasticity, or is this just young people?
No. They used to say years ago that your brain stopped growing in the formative years, 6 years old. After 6 years old, that's it. If you didn't have it, you didn't have it. They've now found that that's not true. Your brain is so malleable. It's because of the neuroplasticity, it can change at any time. And there's tons of stuff out there, you know, for those of us who've gotten to a point where we forget things, where you can do brain games and different things like that. And those brain games are very good. They're domain specific, kind of a start and stop type position. But the neuroplasticity works with everyone. In fact, I just recently came across some research from the interactive metronome people where they're actually doing work with Alzheimer's patients.
Mm.
So that there is an ability to help kind of bring it backwards. And, you know, I can even say myself, and my children are grown and I have grandchildren, so there's times that I get discouraged. And growing up as a student, as a child, I struggled with dyscalculia, which is the math version of dyslexia. I couldn't understand math to save my life. Mm-hmm. And I would 9 out of 10 times sit and cry if I even looked at a math page. Mm-hmm. And it was in, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years, and 5 years ago, I all of a sudden noticed how numbers made so much sense to me, and patterns and things that I could never do, I could suddenly do. And I believe very strongly that it's all of the metronome stuff that I do with children have impacted my brain, where things I couldn't do or things that would forgetfulness, different things aren't as big of a problem for me.
Mm-hmm.
So if that makes sense. But there is research that neuroplasticity and the metronome also specifically does help with what they call the aging brain.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you ever given IQ tests? Now, I know the value of IQ tests, everyone has their own thoughts. Some, you know, say they shouldn't be paid attention to at all. The results shouldn't be paid attention to. Have you ever tested the people you work with before they started with this interactive metronome work, tested their IQ, and then later? Does this affect somebody's IQ, or does it not touch that? It just affects their ability to deal with what IQ they have.
I kind of have a personal bias on that, to be honest with you. First off, I do not, because I'm not a clinical psychologist, I don't do IQ testing. I do test for various things like timing and rhythm of the brain, some of the general academic different programs that will tell me baselines for academic capabilities, as well as, like I said, the brain timing. And usually I will refer out for an IQ test, or somebody will come to me after their students already had an IQ test. When a student takes an IQ test, and here again, this is my bias. When a student takes an IQ test, they, if they're not in a good mood and they don't feel like answering questions, or they just answer it quickly, they're gonna somewhat skew the results of that test. And I don't think it's a horrible change in it, but it's somewhat, you know, changed. If all of a sudden they're able to process information and they're doing effectively and they take an IQ test again, that IQ test will go up because they are attending to the task or attending to the questions, and they're focused and they're driven and they complete it. So I've never, to be honest with you, I've never had somebody who's left my practice tell me a change in their student's IQ. So I wouldn't know how to, I can't give a factual response to that. I can only give my opinion and how I believe it would work.
Well, that's what you're being asked for. Now, Lee, if somebody wants to know more about your work, how can they learn more? You have a website. What do you have people could look for?
My website is www.cognition.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can also go to the interactive metronome, all one word, .com. And there's a tremendous amount of research. It will link me. I believe mine also will link to the Interactive Metronome organization.
Mm-hmm. Lee, thank you very much for being a guest on my show. And maybe I'll run into you when you're walking your dog and I'm walking down the street. I hope.
Well, I hope to see you again. And thank you again very much for this.